Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Reel 2. Now, how else did the war affect you at school? Any other ways? You know, you've got the fire watching. Was there an OTC started or army cadets? Or?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that because I had been a scout, a very keen scout.
Well, we'll do that first then because that's quite right. Tell me about your Boy Scouts activities. We're particularly interested in any military element to it in the sense that they were originally founded for that purpose.
Yes, they were. Now, this was... we had a very keen school troop, and the skipper was one of the schoolmasters, a chap called Cox, and he was excellent. He was one of the first to be called up, unfortunately, because he was obviously very young. But he was a very keen scout and a very... I was going to say he was a religious man, but he certainly had a sort of religious attitude towards scouting, and which was very good, because he certainly didn't impose it on us, but he taught us a great deal.
Now, what did he teach?
Well, he taught the idea of being a scout, being helpful, being courteous, thinking about other people rather than oneself. He took us to various camps, and we used to go for weekend camps even when food was rationed and so on. It was sometimes quite difficult to get stuff to cook on a campfire, but he taught us about tents and fire, lighting fires and cooking in the open, and inspired us very much into an extremely vigorous and worthwhile troop.
Any drill, or informal or otherwise?
No drill as such. I remember trying to concoct some interest in. We used to have these awful long staves. We used to call them long 6-foot poles, which were supposed to be part of the scout rig out. And I remember we handled these very badly, and I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to have some sort of drill that somebody could say, right, shoulder staves or trail staves, but we had no idea how to do it, and it was a pretty dismal effort. But apart from that, I was a very keen scout, and we learned an awful lot, because you could acquire a knowledge on all sorts of subjects and get a badge for achieving a certain standard, and I suppose the competition was to see how many badges one could collect, which we used to wear on our sleeves. It looked awful, I expect. I mean, that's what we did. But I remember dabbling in all sorts of subjects which I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. I can't even remember what they were at the moment, but
they broadened your mind.
It certainly broadened mine, and broadened your one's ability to do things. I remember learning to tie knots and to do lashings and all that sort of thing, which I suppose were fairly useful.
And cooking and camping, and sort of self-sufficiency. And,
oh yes, looking after yourself. And
now, what years were you in the Scouts, roughly?
Well, I must have joined when I was 10 or 11.
So 1936.
And, yes, certainly. And I remember achieving my first class, whatever it was called, a scout first class, before I was 14, because I couldn't get made a first class scout till I was after 14, till I'd reached the age of 14. I can remember that. But then one of the schoolmasters, I can't remember his name just now, but he decided to form what was then called the Air Defence Cadet Corps, which later became the ATC. And because he was so quick off the mark, the Heel School ATC Air Training Corps was number 13, and because it was one of the earliest formed, we had a, in brackets, F. So it was a 13F squad, which he was very proud of, having managed to get enough interest so early in the formation of the Air Defence Cadet Corps.
So when did he form it?
When?
That would be 39, would it? Or?
Oh, very early in 39, if not 38, but very, very early. I can't honestly remember.
Did you do the? You did the two things side by side. The boys.
No, I gave up scouts
in 38.
Yeah, about 38 or 39 that time to join the Air Training Corps.
Now, tell me about the air. How was the Air Training Corps? It was a Heald school, wasn't
it? No, Heald, H-E-L-E apostrophe S, Heald. A bloke called, a lady maybe, called Heald, founded the school way back. It no longer exists.
Now, tell me, what was the composition of the air training? How many were in it? How was it organised?
Well, the schoolmaster was the officer, and he persuaded another schoolmaster at the school to help him to join him and to help run the thing. And we just recruited from the more senior people in the school, and we were what, 50 or 60 strong, I suppose, when the squad that I remember being marched around in, because I learnt all my basic drill with the ATC, which was excellent.
Well, tell me about the drill then. I mean, how did you take to drill? Because not everyone takes to it straight away, or some, not at all. How did you take to it?
Well, it was just one of the things that the ATC did. It went on parade, and it we soon got the swing of thing. We had a very good cadet sergeant who later became a cadet warrant officer. So that was very high ranking in the cadet setup, but he was quite good at drill, and we spent some part, I suppose, of each of the. We used to meet, let's say, one evening a week, or perhaps it was immediately after school. Had finished because if you could get home in daylight, it was always an incentive. An attraction, and safer, I guess, because more accidents happened during the blackout. But road accidents, there was never any danger of being molested or attacked or whatever in those days. So we did drill, and what we learnt, the Air Force type of drill, which we're fairly good at, I suppose. And certainly when later on, that became very helpful to me. So,
did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed. Drill? Yes, I didn't dislike drill. It was just a thing that had to be endured.
Did you understand the point of it at that early age?
No, I don't think so. It was just a thing one did.
What about uniform? Did you what ATC uniform did you get?
Yes,
Air Defence Cadet Corps early on.
Yeah. I mean, we all got this the uniform. You were measured, and even short-arsed people like myself got suitably equipped with a uniform and a forage cap. And we learnt, but part of the drill was just a way of assembling. We started off with being on parade and drill, and then we learnt such things as Morse code and meteorology and navigation, and I don't think we did very much armaments in those days. But
we'll have to go in a bit more detail. The Morse code. How far did you already know it? A lot of boys already knew it.
No. Well, we fiddled about with it in scouts, but we were never very good at it.
Now, how did they teach you Morse code, and how did you do it?
Well, I don't remember the actual start. How you learnt the actual A, B, C, D. But I remember having this buzzer, which somebody would send a message. And I remember distinctly you used to put words or in five-letter codes, meant nothing at all, but just five consecutive letters. And I remember, you know, having learnt the alphabet, graduating from writing it in capitals to writing, I think it was called plain language, when you wrote as you would write a letter. And it became, we became so good at it at about 10 or 12 words a minute, which is the sort of speed we did, and writing it out in longhand. And it was quite good. So we learnt it by sound, by buzzer, and then we also learnt to do it by light. We had an Aldis lamp, which we clicked about, and learnt to do it by light. So because of the ATC and this basic background, we learned that there was a way of entering the Air Force.
Hang on, a bit more about the training process. Okay. Pick up the other two things. We're going fine. Now, what about navigation? We're always interested in how far you go with it. Navigation, it goes a long way or not
very
far.
It was very, very basic. Very basic. We learnt the difference between true north and magnetic north. And magnetic east is magnetic least, or I've even forgotten what that was now. But so we learnt to be fairly familiar with plotting from A to B and taking into account the difference between true north and magnetic north, and so that's compass reading. And so we learnt it all in theory. Well, not all. We learned about it in theory.
What about wind drift? I mean, this takes us into the next thing you mentioned, meteorology.
Yes.
I don't know how far you got with that either.
Well, again, I'm sure we only just tickled the edge of the subject, but we learned how to do a plot from A to B to lay off for the wind. I think that's a good expression, isn't it? You know, how it worked out. But we were under no pressure, so there's no you didn't have to do it quickly. Later on, one had to do it much more quickly. So that but that basic knowledge was excellent.
What about aircraft recognition? Was quite common in
No, that was very, very good too. Yes.
Now, how did you do that? I mean, was it something you were interested in anyway? Aircraft recognition. A lot of boys again were or not.
Yes, I was moderately interested in it because it was very, very important to realise that, you know, you were only going to have some time or other, maybe only a split second to recognise whether it was friendly or foe.
How did they train you in it?
Well, we had models, like Airfix models, and they weren't called out in those days, but there were models, and in the sort of, if we had an ATC room, and I'm sure we did, they would have been strung from the ceiling and so on. So you'd be seeing these models in the strung on a piece of cotton or whatever, piece of wire. You know, frequently you'd see them all the time. So you, as schoolboys, you got to know what the German planes looked like, and our own as well. And some of the chaps became very, very good at it.
Did they teach you about the different engine sound as well? Because the Germans had a different sounding engine.
Yes, they did. You didn't have to teach that because we all acquired that knowledge. You could, at night, you could, you thought you could hear this distinctive hum of a German aircraft. Whether it was true or not, I don't know, but we always kidded ourselves that you could tell the difference.
Any other subjects? You said you didn't do much rifle shooting or any of the army cadet style thing.
We didn't, because we didn't have the facilities at the school.
Any other topics of any other things you learned?
No, I think that was.
You didn't visit airfields on.
Oh yes, well, I'm sorry. Yes, we used to be taken, or we were allowed access to, because we weren't often taken. We had to go there on our bikes. Exeter Airport, as it now is, was RAF Exeter from very early on in the war, and later became an airfield used by Battle of Britain squadrons. So we used to go cycle out there and because we were in uniform, we didn't, as I recall, didn't even have to produce a pass or a, we might have to produce your identity card, which we had to carry, everybody had to carry, at the gate, if you could wake the sentry up, you know, because they weren't, I don't think they were like the army, they weren't very military in the entry to the airfield. Anyway, we used to turn up and be allowed in, and in parties usually, and we used to go there and try and scrounge lifts in an aeroplane. And I remember, you know, waiting for some hours on the side of a on the perimeter track, waiting for my turn to fly in some ropey old creaky old Oxford or Anson or something. But it was all, if you did get a flight, that was what it was all about.
Do you remember your first flight? People always ask this, but I mean, was it in an Oxford?
Well, I don't remember my first flight in the ATC. I remember my first flights subsequently.
Okay, well, but it didn't make that much of an impression at the time.
No, except that was what we aspired to do, to get a trip, a flight in an aeroplane. One of the things we did at ATC was to go on a summer camp, which was quite interesting. Well, very interesting.
Was this one a year? Or
well, the only one I went on, it must have been one a year, but certainly not more than that. We went down to Mountbatten in Plymouth, where there was a...
Mountbatten,
yeah, Batten.
One word?
No.
Ah, two, that's right.
Two words. Where there were Sunderlands, the Australian squadron flying Sunderlands down there. And when we got there, there was... they knew we were coming, and it had all been arranged by this very excellent... Chesterfield was the man's name, the ATC man, I just remembered. He laid it all on. But when we got down to Mountbatten, there was no accommodation for us. So suddenly a big lorry turned up and just turfed out some bales, which we were told contained a marquee and some poles and some ropes, and there you are, get on with it. And nobody had a clue about putting up a marquee, except perhaps me. I never put up a marquee, but I put up a tent or two in the scout. So we had a sergeant, who was a prefect at school, called Matthews, who turned to me and said, "Do you know anything about putting up tents then?" "Well, you should know something about putting up tents, being a scout." And I said, "Well, yes, I suppose I do." He said, "Go on then, get the marquee erected." And now we were sharing this camp with a Plymouth squadron, who, of course, we didn't know anything about. And later on fought with them with pillows, which was a pretty disastrous affair. But at that time, the war hadn't broken out between the two squadrons. So it was obviously, if we didn't do something about putting up this marquee, it wouldn't get done.
So this would be, what, August or July?
I think it was the... August of the Dieppe Parade, I think it was. So that would be 1942, August 42, am I right? I could look it up in here, because it's...
I thought it was before the war.
Well, no. The ATC was formed during early on, before the war probably, but so I didn't join it until...
Yeah, this is... I've got you. So 1942...
I think it was August 1942. As I say, if it's important, I can look it up. I've got it buried here somewhere. And that's why, you know, nobody had any time to mess about with the ATC cadets. So let them get on with it. There's the marquee. Get it put up. So with a bit of fiddling and a bit of trial and error, we got this marquee up with no particular bother. But I remember having to brief the cadets that I wanted so many, six or eight cadets on each rope, each of the four main ropes, so we could pull this great big central framework, the two poles, which were what, telegraph pole size, they were 5 or 6 inches in diameter, and this ridge pole, which was the same sort of diameter. So they were biggish bits of timber, and I didn't want them thrashing about hitting somebody over the head. And we got it put up. No great bother. It took a little while, I expect, but it got up, and we got the pegs driven into the ground to hold the thing up, and we didn't tear it or didn't. Nothing went particularly wrong with it. I remember having to shin up one of these telegraph poles to unhook something that had got stuck right up the top of the by the where it joined the ridge, and I was pretty anxious that they didn't let go of the ropes whilst I was up there, because it would have been an awful mess and there would have been nobody else to put the marquee up anyway. But it went up, no bother. But then we had the marquee up, and then we had, I think, strips of corrugated iron, and then we had three, what later called in the RAF called biscuits, which were 2 foot 6 by 2 foot 6, thereabouts, squares of some sort of mattress material, three of those each, and a blanket, and that was where we bedded down for 7 days, or was it 14? Anyway.
And what were you actually doing while you were there? What do you remember?
Well, we would. That was the thing, that they hadn't got anything for us to do, and so we were farmed out to various departments, notably the cookhouse. We spent a great deal of every morning peeling potatoes in the cookhouse, which wasn't very exciting, and what we thought we'd gone to Mount Batten to do. But they were so busy that I don't think any of us got any trips on the Sunderland. It was wonderful to see them taking off and landing. They were superb things to watch. And these Australians were an operational squadron. They certainly hadn't got time for messing about with cadets. But we...
Sunderland was an impressive beast, then.
Oh, yes, indeed. But I remember also the parades we had to attend as cadets. And, of course, we put the airmen to shame with our drill, because they were pretty sloppy and couldn't care less about drill, and it was just a question of a formality of starting the day, I suppose, when the flag was raised and everybody standing to attention and all that jazz. But it was pure formality, and the regular people on the airfield hated the guts of the cadets, because they were so much smarter and better at drill than they were. So I remember that sort of feeling creeping through the thing quite a lot. But I'd like to think we did something to help, but I can't remember doing anything helpful.
Anything else about the... So you were with them till 42? So from 39 to 42?
Yes, something like that.
Now, what about... So you left school... So you left school in 42 as well, then, did you?
Yes.
Now, what were you going to do when you left school?
Well, I was... my father organised that I would be articled to an architect, so that's what I did. I started learning architecture, and I really, honestly, didn't have my heart in it. I was very good at drawing and draftsmanship and that sort of work, which I quite enjoyed. But I really only tickled the edge architecture as such, because I knew I was going to join up.
So you couldn't concentrate properly on it?
Well, yes, couldn't concentrate. Nice way of putting it. I don't think I had my heart in it.
So you're doing that, what, 42?
Well, and I joined up in 43.
So you worked throughout in the architecture office, that's what you did.
Yes.
Now, what about the actual Blitz, before we leave, you know, because I'm not quite sure on that one. I think it was 42, but I'm not sure in Exeter.
Could be.
What do you remember of the Blitz as it affected life and any close escapes or otherwise from the bombing?
Well, my brother was in the army, away in the army, so there was only my mother and father, my sister and myself, and the dog
the grandparents had gone back.
The grandparents at that time had gone back to, they lived somewhere else, but maybe had gone back to Bristol. But say they weren't there during the Blitz, certainly. And we all went to bed as usual one night, and sometime during the night, the air raid alarm siren went off, and we used, I'd say sometimes we didn't bother to get up, because the siren used to go off, nothing happened, and so we got took to staying in bed. But on this occasion, there was obviously more activity, there was more air activity, and there was anti-aircraft guns being fired, so there was a lot of noise, and I think probably searchlights. And flares, because you got up, pulled the curtains, and the place was like daylight outside, which was pretty alarming. So, when my father was on duty in the, I told you he was a special policeman, and he had the job of going on to some sort of observation place, some miles away from where we lived. And he was on duty that night, and his part of his job was to, in this outpost, wherever he was, of plotting where bombs fell, and then to report that to the police or the fire headquarters. And he had the unfortunate job of reporting that there was a bomb or two in Pennsylvania, where we lived, of course. And so he was very concerned that for us and the house. So he wasn't in the house. Well, we all took refuge in the hall, where we thought was the least vulnerable part of the house. And the hall had a proverbial hat stand, like a cupboard with no front, where you hung hats and coats. And I remember during the bombs falling, this bloody hat stand fell down on top of us. And there was my mother and my sister, myself and the dog. My mother was very deaf and she couldn't hear whether the siren all clear had gone or not, or whether the bombs were falling or not. And she always used to say that if she had to leave the house, she wasn't going to leave her prized possession, her fur coat, behind. So she always wore her fur coat as a dressing gown during a bomb scare, and she was on the floor in the hall, and this blessed hat stand fell down on top of us. And at first we thought it was the house, you know, bits of the house falling in, and eventually we got this hat stand propped up again. And told my mother it's all right to come up now. So she used to uncover her head from this fur coat. And a bomb did land quite close to the house. And it blew out of the front room, the drawing room window. It was a metal frame window. And the whole thing just blew out into the garden. And very few panes of glass. It was small panes of glass, about 18 inches by 12 inches, I suppose, in the frame. And I remember putting the whole frame back in again, and only about two panes of glass had actually broken. The whole thing had gone out into the garden. So we picked up afterwards, next day, picked it all up, popped it back in, and some builders nailed it in position, and it stayed in that position, as far as I know, ever since. But